Blog Talk Radio.
Hyperboreans, trolls and chimps, back here for another show. Today I'm going to be getting into Jung Woltonism, and also be going into sort of CI Wahhabism and Christian right-wing American patriots. So it should be a pretty stacked show. And we'll see what we can do for you. And you are listening to Renegade Broadcasting. Date is 22nd of May, 2013. And if you're listening live through Blog Talk, come out and check us out at renegadebroadcasting.com. You can join in the chat room. And you can check out all the great hosts we have on Renegade. Monday, we got Kyle with Blitzkrieg Broadcast. Tuesday, Dana with Imperium Europa. Wednesdays is me. Thursdays is Mike Sledge with Reconstructions Live. And Friday, we have Siegfried with Ragnarok Now. We'll just get right into it. And I'll be reading first an essay from Jung called Wotan. Now, Wotan was the essay that turned David Lane into a Wotanist. I think it's a pretty important piece of literature here. And this is the version from Temple of Wotan, Holy Book of the Aryan Tribes by Ron McVan and Katja Lane. So I haven't read that yet. Had it recommended to me a couple times recently, so I'll have to get into that. And it starts with a Nostradamus quote. And it says, In Germany shall Devers sex rise, coming very near to happy paganism. The heart captivated while receiving shall open the gate to pay the true tithe. That's from 1995, Prophecies of Nostradamus. So, let's get into it here. I just want to grab my glasses here. When we look back to the time before 1914, we find ourselves living in a world of events which would have been inconceivable before the war. We are even beginning to regard war between civilized nations as a fable, thinking that such an absurdity would become less and less possible in our rational, internationally organized world. And what came after the war was a veritable witch's Sabbath. Everywhere, fantastic revolutions, violent altercations of the map, recursions in politics to medieval or even antique prototypes, totalitarian states that engulf their neighbors and outdo all previous theocracies in their absolutist claims, persecutions of Christians and Jews, wholesale political murder, and finally we have witnessed a lighthearted years. In the realm of philosophy, we shall have to wait some time before anyone is able to assess this kind of age we are living in. But in the sphere of religion, we can see at once that some very significant things have been happening. We need to feel no surprise that in Russia, the colorful splendors of the Eastern Orthodox Church have been superseded. With the sublime and invisible omnipresence of God was not crowded out as superfluity of sacred nail. Tasteless and pitiful, unintelligent as it is, and however deplorable the low spiritual level of the scientific reaction, it was inevitable that the 19th century scientific enlightenment should one day dawn on Russia. But what is more than curious, indeed piquant to a degree, is that an ancient god of storm and frenzy, the long Ossian Wotan, should awake like an extinct volcano to new activity in a civilized country that had long been supposed to have outgrown the Middle Ages. We have seen him come to life in the German youth movement and right at the beginning of the excuse me, right at the beginning, the blood of several sheep was shed in honor of its resurrection. Armed with rucksack and loot, blonde youths, and sometimes girls as well, were seen to be restless wanderers on every road from North Cape to Sicily, faithful votaries of the roving god. Later, towards the end of the Weimar Republic, the wandering role was taken over by thousands of unemployed, who were to be met with everywhere on their aimless journeys. By 1933, they wandered no longer, but marched in their hundreds of thousands. The Hitler movement literally brought the whole of Germany to its feet, from 5-year-olds to veterans, and produced a spectacle of a nation migrating from one place to another. Wotan the Wanderer was on the move. He could be seen looking rather shamefaced in the meeting house of a sect of simple folk in North Germany, disguised as Christ sitting on a white horse. I do not know if these people were aware of Wotan's ancient connection with the figure of Christ and Dionysus, but it's very probable. Wotan is a restless wanderer who creates unrest and stirs up strife now here, now there, and works magic. He was soon changed by Christianity into the devil, and only lived on in fading local traditions as a ghostly hunter who had seen with his retinue flickering like the will-o'-wisp through the stormy night. In the Middle Ages, the role of the restless wanderer was taken over by Ahasuerus, the wandering Jew, which is not a Jewish but a Christian legend. The motif of the wanderer who had not accepted Christ and was projected on the Jews in the same way as we always rediscover our unconscious psyche contents in the other people. At any rate, the coincidence of anti-Semitism with the reawakening of Wotan as a psychological stability that may be worth mentioning. The German youths who celebrated the solstice with sheep sacrifices were not the first to hear the rustling in the primeval forest of unconsciousness. They were anticipated by Nietzsche, Schuller, Stefan Dorsch, and Ludwig Gages. The literary tradition of the Rhineland and the country to the south of the Main has a classical stump that cannot be gotten rid of. Every interpretation of intoxication and exuberance is apt to be taken back to classical models, to Dionysus, to the pure Antonius, and the cosmogonic Eros. No doubt it sounds better to attic ears to interpret these things as Dionysus, but Wotan might be a more correct interpretation. He is the god of storm and frenzy, on winter of passions and the lust of battle. Moreover, he is a superlative magician and artist in illusion who was versed in all secrets of an occult nature. Nietzsche's case is certainly a peculiar one. He had no knowledge of Germanic literature. He discovered the cultural Philistine, and the announcement that God is dead led him to Zarathustra's meeting with an unknown god in unexpected form, who approached him sometimes as an enemy and sometimes disguised as Zarathustra himself. Zarathustra, too, was a soothsayer, a magician, and a stormwind. And like a wind shall I come to blow among them, and with my spirit shall take away the breath of their spirit. My drill, truly a strong wind is Zarathustra to all that are low. And this counsel gives he to his enemies and all to that spit and spew. Beware of spitting against the wind. And Zarathustra dreamed that he was guardian of the greys in the lone mountain. Whistling, shrieking, black coffin before me. And amid the warring and whistling and shrieking, the coffin burst open and out spotted a dozen people. of laughter. The disciple who interpreted the dream said to his disciple, "Are you not yourself the wind with shrill whistling, which bursts through the gates of the forest of death? Are you not yourself the cup filled with life's gay malice and angel grimaces?" In 1864, in his poem to the unknown God, Nietzsche had written, "I shall and will know thee, unknown one, who searches out the depths of my soul and blowest through my life like a storm. Ungraspable and yet my kinsman, I shall know thee and serve thee." Okay, I'm hearing, here I am getting a little bit of audio trouble there. Let me just play a song and reconnect. How long? Just one moment. Cutting out. Yeah, it seems all right. Not hearing any complaints. Still choppy, huh? All right. Let's sit back and go in with the phone. It's gonna be another second.
Oh, yonder stands the prophet, words of music to our ears. But down among the sinners, only pain and sweat and tears. Oh, the sermon soothes the simple, but the rest are wrapped with fear. the best laid plans of history lie the ruins of the past, and the chronicle of suffering shows the mythic Paul A. Kent to believe in true religion, but to see in truth at last. Oh no, too late to hold a trial. Time doesn't wait for the watchmaker dial. Time doesn't wait for the watchmaker dial.
All right, just cut that off early. It's run out of time. So I'll try again with the landline here. So probably just going to have to get some kind of telephone headset thing. So I'll just go back to the show then. Let's see where we were. Okay, and 20 years later in his Mistral song, he wrote, "Mistral wind, chaser of clouds, killer of gloom, sweeper of skies, raging storm wind, how I love thee. Are we not both the first fruits of the same womb, forever predestined to the same fate?" In the dithyramb known as Adrian's Lament, Nietzsche is completely the victim of the hunter god. Stretched out shuddering, like a half-dead thing whose feet are warmed, shaken by unknown fevers, shivering with the piercing, icy frost arrows hunted by thee, O thoughtful, unutterable, veiled, horrible one, thou huntsman behind a cloud struck down by lightning bolt, thou mocking eye stares at me from the dark, thus I lie, writhing, twisted, tormented, with all these eternal tortures, smitten by thee, cruel huntsman, thou unknown god. The remarkable image of the hunter god is not a mere dithyrambic, figure of speech, but is based on an experience which Nietzsche had when he was 15 years old at Forta. It is described in a book by Nietzsche's sister, Elizabeth Forster Knight. As he was wandering in a gloomy wood at night, he was terrified by a blood-curdling streak from a neighboring lunatic asylum, and soon afterwards he came face to face with a huntsman whose features were wild and uncanny. Setting his whistle to his lips in a valley surrounded by wild scrub, the huntsman blew a shrill blast, and Nietzsche lost consciousness, but awoke again in Forta. It was a nightmare. It is significant that in his dream, Nietzsche, who is in reality, intended to go to Eisleben, Luther's town, discussed with the huntsman the question going instead to Stuschenthal, Valley of the Germans. No one with ears can misunderstand the shrill gristling of the storm god in that eternal wood. Was it really only the classical philologist in Nietzsche that led to the god being called Dionysus instead of Wotan? Or was it perhaps due to his fateful meeting with Wagner? In his Reach Un Room, which was first published in 1919, Bruno Goetz saw the secret of the coming events in Germany in the form of a very strange vision. I have never forgotten this little book, for it struck me at a time as a forecast of the German weather. It anticipates the conflict between the realm of ideas and life, between Wotan's dual nature as a god of storm and a god of secret musings.
Wotan disappeared when his oak fell and disappeared again when the Christian God proved too weak to save Christendom from fratricidal slaughter. When the Holy Father at Rome could only impotently lament before the God the fate of the Grex Secretaris, the one-eyed hunter, on the edge of the German forest, laughed and settled Sleipnir. We are always convinced that the modern world is a reasonable world, basing our opinion on economic, political, and psychological factors. But if we may forget for a moment that we are living in the year of our Lord, 1936, and laying aside our well-meaning, all-too-human reasonableness, may burden God or the gods with the responsibility for contemporary events instead of man, we would find Wotan quite suitable for a casual hypothesis. In fact, I mentioned the heretical suggestion that the unfathomable depths of Wotan's character explain more of National Socialism than all three reasonable factors put together. There is no doubt that each of these factors explain an important aspect of what is going on in Germany, but Wotan explains yet more. He is particularly enlightening in regard to a general phenomenon which is so strange to anybody not a German that it remains incomprehensible, even after the deepest reflection. Perhaps we may sum up this general phenomenon as Ergriffenheit, a state of being seized or possessed. This term postulates not only an Ergriffer, one who is seized, but also an Ergriffer, one who seizes. Wotan is an Ergriffer of man. And unless one wishes to deify Hitler, which has indeed actually happened, he is really only the explanation. It is true that Wotan shares this quality with his cousin Dionysus, but mainly on women. The Maenades were a species of female stormtroopers, and according to mythical reports, were dangerous enough. Wotan confined himself to berserkers, who found their vocation as the black shirts of mythical kings. A mind that is still childish still thinks of gods as metaphysical entities existing in their own right, or else regards them as playful or superstitious inventions. From either point of view, the parallel between Wotan redivides us and the social, political, and psychic storm that is shaking Germany might have at least the value of a parable. But since the gods are without doubt personifications of psychic forces, to assert their metaphysical existence as much as an intellectual presumption as the opinion that they could never be invented. Not that psychic forces have anything to do with the conscious mind, fond of as we are of playing the idea that consciousness and psyche are identical. This is not only another piece of intellectual presumption. Psychic forces have far more to do with the realm of the unconscious. Our mania for rational explanations obviously has roots in our fear of metaphysics, for the two have always been hostile. Hence, anything unexpected that approaches us from the dark realm is regarded as either coming from the outside and therefore as real, or as a hallucination and therefore not true. The idea that anything could be real or true which does not come from the outside has hardly begun to dawn on contemporary man. For the sake of better understanding and to avoid prejudice, we could, of course, dispense the name Wotan and speak instead of the Fuhrer Teutonicus. But we should only be saying the same thing and not as well, for the Fuhrer, in this case, is mere psychologizing of Wotan and tells us no more than the Germans are in a state of fury. We thus lose sight of the most peculiar feature of the whole phenomenon, namely the dramatic aspect of the Ergriffer in the has infected a whole nation to such an extent that everything is set in motion and has started rolling on its old course towards perdition. It seems to me that Wotan hits the mark as a hypothesis. Apparently, he was only asleep in the Kyfuser Mountains until the ravens called him and announced the break of day. He is a fundamental attribute of the German psyche, an irrational psyche factor which acts as a high pressure of a civilization like a cyclone as it blows away. Despite the crankiness, the Wotan worshippers seem to have judged things more correctly than the worshippers of reason. Apparently, everyone who had forgotten Wotan is Germanic. Datum of his Apparently, everyone had forgotten that Wotan is a Germanic datum of the first importance. The trust expression and unsurpassed personification of a fundamental quality that is particularly characteristic of the Germans. Houston Stuart Chamberlain is a synonym which arouses suspicion that other veiled gods may be sleeping elsewhere. The emphasis on the German race, commonly called Aryan, the Germanic heritage, blood and soil, the Wagawelia songs, the Rite of the Valkyries, Jesus as a blonde and blue-eyed hero, the Greek mother of St. Paul, the devil as an international Albrecht in German and Jewish or Masonic guise, the Nordic aura Borealis as the light of civilization, the inferior Mediterranean races, all this is the indispensable scenery for the drama that is taking place at the bottom. They all mean the same thing. A god has taken possession of the Germans and their house is filled with a mighty rushing wind. It is soon after Hitler seized power, if I am not mistaken, that a cartoon appeared in Punch of a raving berserker tearing himself free from his bonds. A hurricane has broken loose in Germany, while we believe it is in fine weather. Things are comparatively quiet in Switzerland, though occasionally there is a puff of wind from the north or so. Sometimes it has a slightly ominous sound. Sometimes it whispers so harmlessly or even idealistically that no one is alarmed. Let the sleeping dogs lie. We manage to get along pretty well from this proverbial wisdom. It is sometimes that the Swiss are singularly adverse to making problems of themselves. I must rebut this accusation. The Swiss do have their problems, but they would not admit it for anything in the world, even though they see which way the wind is blowing. We thus pay our tribute to the time of the storm and stress in Germany, but we never mention it. This enables us to feel vastly superior. It is above all the Germans who have an opportunity, perhaps unique in history, to look into their own hearts and learn what these perils of the soul and from where and from which Christianity tried to rescue mankind. Germany is a land of spiritual catastrophes where nature never seems to make more than a pretense of peace with a world-ruling reason. The disturber of peace is a wind that blows into Europe from Asia's vastness, sweeping in on a wide front from Thrace to the Baltic, scattering the nations before it, like dry leaves, inspiring thoughts try to shake the world to its foundation. It is an elemental Dionysus, breaking into the Apollonian order. The rouser of this tempest is named Wotan, and we can learn a good deal about him from the political confusion and spiritual upheaval he has caused throughout history. For a more exact investigation of his character, however, we must go back to the Age of Myths, which do not explain everything in terms of man and his limited capabilities, but sought the deeper cause in the psyche and its autonomous powers. Man's earliest intuitions personified these powers as gods and described them in their myths with great care and circumstantiality according to their various characters. This could be done more readily on account of the firmly established primordial types of images which are innate in the consciousness of many races and exert a distinct influence upon them. Because the behavior of a race takes on its specific character from its underlying images, we can speak of an archetype Wotan as an autonomous psyche factor. Wotan produces effects in the collective life of a people and thereby reveals his own nature. For Wotan has a peculiar biology of his own, quite apart from the nature of man. It is only from time to time that individuals fall under the irresistible influence of this unconscious factor. When it is quiescent, one is no more aware of this archetype Wotan than a latent epilepsy. Could the Germans who were adults in 1914 have foreseen what it would be like today? Such amazing transformations are the effect of the god of wind, that bloweth where it list. Though it hears the sound thereof, it cannot tell from whence it cometh, nor whether it goeth. It seizes everything on its path and overthrows everything that is not firmly rooted. When the wind blows, it shakes everything that is insecure, whether without or within. Excuse me. Okay. Back to the rating here. Let's see how much is left in here. That was quite a bit, actually. Martin Ninck has recently published a monograph which is a most welcome addition to our knowledge of Wotan's nature. The reader need not fear that this book has nothing but a scientific study written with academic aloofness on the subject. Certainly the way to scientific objectivity is fairly preserved. The material has been collected with extraordinary thoroughness and presented in an unusually clear form. But over and above all of this, one feels that the author is vitally interested in it, that the chord of Wotan is vibrating in him, too. This is no criticism. On the contrary, it is one of the chief merits of the book, which without this enthusiasm might easily have degenerated into a tedious catalog. Ninck sketches really a magnificent portrait of the German archetype Wotan. He describes him in 10 chapters, using all the available sources as the Berserker, the God Storm, the Wanderer, the Warrior, the Wunsch and Mien God, and the God and the Lord of the Dead, and of the Einheiser, the Master of Secret Knowledge, the Magician, and the God of Poets. Neither the Valkyries nor the Freyja are forgotten, for they form part of the mythological background and faithful significance of Wotan. Ninck's inquiry... excuse me, someone just stopped messaging me there. Ninck's inquiry into the name and its origin is particularly instructive. He shows that Wotan is not only a god of rage and frenzy, who embodies the instinctual and emotional aspect of the unconscious. Its intuitive and aspiring side also manifests itself in him. And for the runes, for he understands the runes and can interpret its fate. The Romans identified Wotan with Mercury, but his character does not really correspond to any Roman or Greek god. Although there are certain resemblances, he is a wanderer like Mercury. For instance, he rules over the dead like Pluto and Kronos, and is connected with Dionysus by his emotional frenzy, particularly in its manic aspect. It is surprising that Ninck does not mention Hermes, the god of revelation, who, as Funia and Nous, is associated with the wind. He would be the connecting link with the Christian... how was that? Pneuma, it's a Greek term I don't quite recognize, P-N-E-U-M-A, and the miracle of Pentecost. As Poimerides, the shepherd of men, Hermes is an engrafer like Wotan. Ninck rightly points out that Dionysus and the other Greek gods always remained under the supreme authority of Zeus, which indicates a fundamental difference between the Greek and Germanic temperament. Ninck assumes an inner affinity between Wotan and Kronos, and the latter's defeat may perhaps be a sign that the Wotan archetype was once overcome and split up in pure Stirrup times. At all events, the Germanic god represents a totality on a primitive level, a psychological condition in which man's will was almost identical with the gods and entirely at his mercy. but the Greeks had gods who helped man against the other gods. Indeed, our father Zeus himself is not far from the ideal of a benevolent, enlightened despot. It was not in Wotan's nature to linger on and show signs of old age. He simply disappeared when the times turned against him and remained invisible for more than 1,000 years, working anonymously and indirectly. Archetypes like riverbeds which dry up when the water deserts them, but it can find itself again at any time. An archetype is like an old water course, along with the water of life that has flowed for centuries, digging a deep channel for itself. The longer it has flowed in this channel, the longer excuse me. I had a good drink of water. The longer it has flowed in this channel, the more likely it is that sooner or later the water will return to its old bed. The life of the individual as a member of society, and particularly as a spirit of the state, may be regulated like a canal, but like the life of nations is a great rushing river in which it is beyond human control, in the hands of the one who has always been stronger than men. The League of Nations, which was supposed to possess supernatural authority, is regarded as some as a child in need of protection, and by others as an abortion. Thus, the life of nations rolls on unchecked, without guidance, unconscious of where it is going, like a rock crashing down the side of a hill, until it is stopped by an obstacle larger than itself. Political events move from one impasse to the next, like a torrent caught in gullies, creeks, and marshes. All human control comes to an end when the individual is caught in a mass movement. Then all the archetypes begin to function as it happens and in the lives of individuals when they are confronted with situations that cannot be dealt with in any of the familiar ways. But what if a so-called Führer does it with a mass movement can plainly be seen if we turn our eyes to the north or south of our country. And the ruling archetype does not remain the same forever, as is evident from the temporal limitations that has been set to the hoped reign of peace, the thousand-year Reich. The Mediterranean father archetype of the just, order-loving, and benevolent ruler has been shattered throughout the whole of Northern Europe, as the present fate of the Christian churches bears witness. Fascism in Italy and the civil war in Spain show that the South, as well as the long cataclysm, has been far greater than one expected. Even the Catholic Church can no longer afford the trials of strength. The nationalist God has attacked Christianity on a broad front. In Russia, he is called technology and science. In Italy, Dulce, and Germany, German faith, German Christianity, or the state. The German Christians are a contradiction on many terms and would do better to join Hauer's German faith movement. And just so you guys know, the German faith movement was actually somewhat of this idea of pan-Aryan ideology, where they would mix the old Vedic religions along with German folk religions and everything else that came between, like Gnosticism and things like this. And where was I here? All right. These are decent and well-meaning people who honestly admit their ungrievenheit and try to come to terms with this new and undeniable fact. They go to an enormous amount of trouble to make it less alarming by dressing it up in a conciliatory historical garb and giving us consoling glimpses of great figures such as Mr. Eichhardt, who is also a German and Ingriffen. In this way, the awkward question of who is the Ingriffer is also circumvented. He was always God, and that's one who restricts. But the more Hauer restricts the world, wide sphere of Indo-European culture to the Nordic in general, and to the Ida in particular. The more German this faith has become as a manifestations of Griesenheit, the more painfully evident that the German God is the God of the Germans. One cannot read Hauer's book without emotion. If one regards it as the tragic and really heroic effort of a conscientious scholar, without knowing how it happened to him, was violently summoned by the inaudible voice of the engraver, who is now all his might and all his knowledge and ability to build a bridge between the dark forces of life and the shining world of historical ideas. But what do all the beauties of the past on totally different levels of culture mean to the man of today? When confronted with a living and unfathomable tribal god, unfathomable, that he has never experienced before, they are sucked like dry weeds into the roaring whirlwind, and the rhythmic alliterations of the Ida become inextricably mixed up with Christian and mystical texts, German poetry, and the wisdom of the Upanishads. Hauer himself is engriffen, and the depths of the meaning and the primal words lying at the root of Germanic languages, to the extent he certainly never knew before. Hauer the Indologist was never to blame for this, nor is the Ida. It is rather the fault of the Kairos, the present moment of time, whose name on closer investigation turns out to be Wotan. I would therefore advise the German faith movement to throw aside their scruples. Intelligent people will not confuse them with the crude Wotan worshippers whose faith is a mere pretense. There are people in the German faith movement who are intelligent enough not only to believe but to know that the God of the Germans is Wotan and not the Christian God. This is a tragic experience and no disgrace. It has always been terrible to fall into the hands of a living God. Yahweh was no exception to this rule. The Philistines, Edomites, Amorites, and the rest who were outside of the Yahweh experience and most certainly found it exceedingly disagreeable. The Semitic experience of Allah was for a long time an extremely painful affair for the whole of Christendom. We who stand outside the Germans far too much as if they were responsible agents, but perhaps it would, we who stand outside judge the Germans for far too much, and if they were responsible agents, but perhaps it would be near the truth to regard them also as victims. If we apply admittedly a particular point of view, we are going to his character, but also his ecstatic and mantic qualities, a very different aspect of his nature. If this conclusion is correct, National Socialism would not be the last word. Things must be concealed in the background which we cannot judge, we cannot imagine at the present, but we may expect them to appear in the course of the next few years or decades. Wotan's reawakening is stepping into the past. The stream was dammed up and has broken into its old channel, but the obstruction will not last forever. It is rather a recular pour mix satur, and the water will overlap the obstacle. Then at last we shall know what Wotan is saying when he says, murmurs with Mimir's head. Interesting. Well, that took a little bit longer than I thought it would. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get through all the content I've laid out today, but maybe I'll make a part two for next week and finish off with the Wotan stuff and maybe take a couple calls and then I can get into the rest of what I was going to talk about. So I'm just going to take a quick break, rest my voice, have a smoke, and back in a moment. Okay, and that was Killing Joke with Europe. So now I'm going to get into, let me see if I find it here, a book, The Aryan Christ. I've got a headset to my head, so let's get this open here. Let me see, 1 second, how much more there was before that section there. One second here. All right, sorry about that, that pause there. Okay, so this is from Chapter 7 of The Aryan Christ, The Secret Life of Carl Jung by Richard Noll, N-O-L-L. Chapter 7, The Mystery of Deification. Us surrounds the mysteries, particularly of the mystery of deification. This was one of the most important of the mysteries. It gave immortal value to the individual. It gave certainty of immortality. One gets a peculiar feeling from being through such initiation. C.G. Jung, June 8, 1925. There is a significant deliberate omission from Jung's alleged autobiography. The information Amelia Jaffe left out of memories, dreams, and reflections is crucial to his understanding Jung, his metaphors, the metaphors he chose for his method of psychotherapy and the early development of analytical psychology. Indeed, it forms the core of his personal myth, elements of which he kept secret, but now they can be revealed with a contextual analysis of this important material. Actually, let's skip over this introduction part. Okay, section, Why Do You Worship Me? At the very heart of MDR is the chapter, Confrontation with the Unconscious, for many modern readers who regard MDR as a gospel. MDR is Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, Autobiography, Alleged Autobiography. So, Confrontation with the Unconscious, for many modern readers who regard MDR as a gospel or new spiritual dispensation, this chapter is the holiest of holies. Stories of Jung's visionary journeys of December 1913 and his additional prophetic visions and dreams of subtly model the process of transformation that Jung considered necessary before one could truly become an individual. This chapter offers the promise of such magical experience to others. He insists that such an ordeal is dangerous and that not everyone can survive it. But the official version of Jung's 1913 visions leaves out the most important ingredient of this recipe for individuation, the experience that not all therapeutic techniques were designed to bring out, a new experience of God through one's old self-deification. Let us now compare Jaffe's version in, I'll read that. Jaffe's own version in MDR with Jung's own confession in 1925. Jaffe's version is taken largely from a brief remarks Jung made at the end of the lectures in May 11th and June 1st. Jung introduced dissociative altered state of consciousness and made visionary descent into the unconscious, which he refers to a land as the dead. Once in this other realm, he met an old man with a white beard and a young girl who was blind. The blind man introduced himself as Elijah. Jung was shocked to learn when the girl was named Salome. Actually, Yeah, it's a dream miss. Elijah assured him that this couple had been together since eternity. With them was a large black snake which had infinity for young. They stuck close to Elijah because he seemed to be the most reasonable of the three and to have a clear intelligence. Of Salome, I was distinctly suspicious. In the fall seminar notes, Jung amplified these figures with references to motifs in mythology and symbolism. He explained that the snake is associated with the hero mythos. Salome is the anima figure. Elijah represents the wild old prophet and a factor of intelligence and knowledge. But Jung added, it is very much better to leave these experiences as they are, namely as event experiences. One point on which these two versions diverge is the important figure of Philemon, Jung's eternal hero. In MDR, he reveals that this figure, a pagan living in the Egypto-Hellenistic atmosphere with a Gnostic coloration, developed out of the Elijah figure in subsequent fantasies. Besides covering an almost entire wall in Jung's hermetic tower in Bollingen, images of the wise old Philemon grace the illumined manuscript pages of Jung's secret transformation diary, The Red Book. Philemon is not mentioned in the 1925 seminar. Jung's initial voyage to the underworld was followed by a long-supposed story of Jung's deification. Jung told his audience that I felt I should continue. So I tried to follow the same procedure, but it would not descend. I remained on the surface. He felt it was an inner conflict that prevented him from going down. After resolving this, he felt to go on. Jung looked about him. He saw Elijah on a rocky ridge, a ring of boulders, and which he thought was a druidic sacred place. Inside the old man, he climbed up on the mounted druidic altar, and then both Elijah and the altar began to shrink while the walls grew larger. Jung noticed a tiny woman like a doll who turned out to be Salome. He also saw a miniature snake and a house. The walls around Jung kept growing. Suddenly, he realized he had been descending. I was in the underworld, he said. When they all reached bottom, Elijah smiled at them. Why, it is just the same above or below. Then it happened. Salome became very interested in me, and I assumed I could cure her blindness. She began to worship me. I said, why do you worship me? She replied, you are Christ. I rejected, but Salome persisted. She insisted that he was Christ. Jung told her, this is madness. And he said he became filled with skeptical resistance. But events would soon prove she was right. Then I saw the snake approach me. She came close and began to encircle me and press in her coils. These coils reached up to my heart. I realized as I struggled that I assumed the attitude of the crucifixion. In the agony and the struggle, I sweated profusely and the water flowed down on all sides of me. Then Salome rose as she could see. While the snake was pressing me, I felt that my face had been taken on the face of an animal of prey, a lion or a tiger. Jung then offered the stunned audience some rather formulaic interpretations of the experiences in terms of this type theory. But in meaningful shift of focus, they must have taken only a few minutes during the spoken lecture. Jung then compared his experience with those of the ancient mysteries. You cannot get conscious of those unconscious facts without giving yourself to them. These images have so much reality that they recommend themselves in such extraordinary meaning that one is caught. They form part of the ancient mysteries. In fact, it is such figures that made the mysteries. Jung's interpretation here is clear. His visions were an initiatory experience into the mysteries of the pagan antiquity. These mystery cults provided all the symbols of transformation necessary for personal renewal or rebirth. Further, they were at the deepest level of the unconscious mind, available to one and all who wished to descend into the ancestral unconscious or go into a heroic night sea journey through its murky depths. The gods awaited one there. The climax of the initiation into the mysteries, however, was a mystery of deification, which gave the certainty of immortality. Immortality, Jung's statement of his own deification is remarkable. One gets a particular feeling from being put through such initiation. The important part that led up to the deification was the snakes uncoiling of me. Salome's performance was deification. The animal face, which I felt mine transformed into, was the famous Deus Ionicephalus of the Aetherian Mysteries. It is the figure in which is represented with a snake coiled around the man, the snake's head resting on the man's head, and the face of the man that of the lion. This statue has only been found in mystery grottos, the underchurches, and the last remnants of the catacombs. The catacombs were not originally places of concealment, but were chosen as a symbolical of a descent into the underworld. After presenting a few historical details concerning Mithraism, Jung told his audience, "It is almost certain that the symbolical rite of deification played a part in these mysteries." He then identified as Leotonius. Leontocephalus as Aeon, or the Eternal Being, which he said was derived from an Iranian deity whose name means the infinitely long duration. He described a museum piece he had once seen, a Mithraic amphora that bore the image of the flame with a lion on one side and a snake on the other. To him, these were to be interpreted psychologically as the opposites of the world trying to come together with the reconciling symbol between them. Significantly, the lion is the young, hot, dry July sky, culmination of light of the summer. The serpent is humidity, darkness, the earth, winter. Jung closed this remarkable lecture with a return to the initiatory climax of deification in the ancient mysteries. In this deification mystery, to make yourself into the vessel, you are a vessel of creation which the opposites reconcile. An identified person in the audience then asked Jung the date of this dream, and Jung replied, December 1913. All this is Mithraic symbolism from beginning to end. Before we can understand the true meaning of Jung's initiation, some questions need to be answered. What did Jung have in mind when he spoke of the ancient mysteries? How did he come to the notion that the absolute climax of the initiatory rites of the ancient mystery cults, the humble human initiate becomes a god? What were the Mithraic mysteries, and why would Jung entertain the fantasy of becoming an initiate into them? What was the most important source of these remarkable visions? Why were the mysteries of Mithras such an important model for his own circle of disciples in Uruk? And what did it mean when Jung mixed Christian and pagan elements into his own deified self? To find these answers, we must leave our own narrative and enter a lost world of fin de siècle in classical scholarship, which reflected a mentality quite different than our own. Maybe I should skip that part. Just one second here. I think I'm going to skip over this part. Just most of where we got a lot of sources. And take up too much time. You can look up a lot of this stuff. where was the part I really wanted to read? Alright, just I'll take another quick break here. Sorry, I just need to double check on something here. Alright, sorry about that. Had to take care of something around here. Find that spot. Okay, might as well restart here. So, Leonitica, Jung the Leo, Jung the Leo, Leocephalus. That's pretty close, I think. Sort of sounds like, A closer look at the initiatory process and the mysteries of Mithras reveals a fact about Jung's life that had been hidden for more than 80 years. Based on some of the remarks of the Christian apologist Jerome and archaeological evidence, primarily from the Mithraeum of Velisimus at the Roman seaport of Osita, we know that there were 7 grades of initiation into the Mithraic mysteries. They were in ascending order: Corax, Raven, Nymphus, Embryo, Miles, Soldier, Leo, Lion, Persis, the Persian or the son of Perseus, Helodramus, Sunrunner, and Pater, Father. Most of the references that survive concern Leo and Pater. We know nothing of Persis and Heliodromus, and according to the ancient observer Pallas, while members of the Corax level of initiates were often called servants of those of the grade Leo, known as the Leones, we were welcomed as full participants in the mysteries. Indeed, as the scholar R.L. Gordon observed, reaching the grade Leo remarked a large shift in status from the stage of preparation to membership. In light of this information, I have reached a conclusion. As late as 1925, 12 years after his first experience with active imagination, Jung continued to interpret these experiments as initiation into the Leo grade of the Mithraic mysteries. This special level of initiation into the Mithraic mysteries is known as the Leothnika. Jung, however, never publicly revealed this fact. To verify Jung had prior knowledge of the significance of the great Leo, we need to look no further than the primary source of inspiration, Franz Cumont. In The Mysteries of Mithras, Cumont wrote, "We may conclude from a passage that in Porphyry, that the taking of the first 3 degrees did not authorize participation in the mysteries. Only the mystics had reserved the Leontics became participants, and it is for this reason that the grade of Leo is mentioned more frequently in the descriptions than in the other." Jung admitted his knowledge of the grade Leo in only 2 places in all of his writings, a footnote in Ond Lundgren and his book Mysterium Canionitonis. When comparing these stages, that stands to a new degree of insight, wisdom, and initiation. Just as the Mithraic eagles, lions, and sun messengers signify the grades of initiation, what did it mean to become one of the Leones of the Mysteries of Mithras? And what did his status as Leo mean to Jung? The objects associated with the grade of Leo mark down important bits here. In the Hellenistic world, lions had a special status among the animals. It is believed they could be divided into 2 categories as human beings with intelligence and moral acumen, and as gods who could mete out divine retribution. Furthermore, lions were thought of as fire-filled and intimately associated with the sun, as their powerful fiery breath as a vehicle for divine punishment, as fire is a purifying agent. The initiate who attains the status of Leo therefore assumed powers attributed to lions. Add that there, close that out. There's one particular passage I wanted to get into here, go through it all, but it's taking a little longer than I thought. And you can read up about a lot about Jung's writings on this particular aspect. They're well available online. I won't really get into it too much. Okay, I'll just skip to this part. The old Aryan deity. The key to understanding the Jungian mysteries and their historical roots, at least as Jung perceives them, can be found in Wand Ohrngren und Symbol der Lebioto. And Wand Ohrngren, Jung followed Kumont and Ernest Renan before him in his wistful view that if historical events had gone a little differently, the Western world would be Mithraic today instead of Judeo-Christian. He makes reference to the cultural and spiritual war between the two great antagonistic religions, Christianity on one side and Mithraism on the other. To Jung, the grand solar astronomical and astrological symbol of Mithraism indicate a form of nature worship that could not have been more the more recent product of civilized human life. The mysteries of Mithras are nature worship in the best sense of the word, while the primitive Christians exhibited through an antagonistic attitude to the beauties of the world. Jung's derisive attitude towards Christianity as a product of civilization is even more apparent in the following indictment. In the past 2,000 years, Christianity has done its work and has erected barriers of repression which protect us from the sight of our own sinfulness. The elementary emotions of the libido have become unknown to us, for they are carried in the unconscious. Therefore, the belief which combats them has become hollow and empty. Let whoever does not believe that a mask covers our religion obtain an impression for himself from the appearance of our modern churches, from which style and art have long since fled. Mithraism was far older than Christianity, which only arose in the first century CE, with its solar symbolism and shamanic deification rites in which the initiate takes animalistic powers. It has direct ties to the original nature religion of all human beings. Jung fully believed that the mysteries of Mithras were his direct experiential link to the ancient Aryans. Kumont referred to Mithras as the old Aryan deity, who found new names and new faces in the religions of ancient India and Iran, areas thought to be the homeland of the Aryans. It is possible for this reason that Jung found the Mithraic mysteries so meaningful, and that he placed a greater emphasis on this cult over the other less Aryan Hellenic mysteries, Hellenistic. It is not surprising that between 1909 and 1914, Jung and his assistants Honegger, Spellerein, Nikan, and Schnitzer found that the mythological elements in psychotic symponyms in patients were survivals from ancient Aryan cultures ranging from India, Iran, Greece, and Rome to the ancient Teutons. Other than the occasional biblical reference in solar symbolism, they never once found exclusively Semitic mythological symbols in these patients. This was consistent with the scientific research program of the Zurich School, since in order to prove the validity of the phylogenetic hypothesis, mythological symbols from Aryan sources should predominate among these psychotic Germanic patients. So this is pretty important here. Even with people's mania and their sort of rages and psychosis, you don't see these symbols of these sort of Jewish religion sort of take place when people are in their most raw, as it were. And I would like to mention really quick back on another part that they mentioned there before, and that is the in the past 2,000 years, Christianity has done its work and erected borders of repression which protect us from the sight of our own sinfulness. The elementary emotions of the libido have become unknown to us, for they are carried on in the unconscious. Therefore, the belief which combats them has become hollow and empty. Excuse me. And this is somewhat important. I remember hearing slander about the Cathar Gnostics, and it was said that they believed that sex only for reproduction sex was evil, especially for reproduction. But this wasn't quite their belief, and it was more along the lines of having sex only for reproductive purposes, of which is promoted in the church in itself, is evil. And if you think about it, it's actually a form of dysgenics. And procreation should be a result of wanting to have sex and not the other, because sex without consent is rape. And if, sex without pleasure, even, some would go far to say. And if this contingent is not there and people are disconnecting based on economics and who knows who in the church and who's a friend of whom, proper things aren't happening. And this is probably part of why the Aryan peoples have become so dysgenic. And they lost their connection with nature, which would sort of fuel this and allow people to sort of unconsciously notice where these things would lie. Even today it seems to have even gotten worse when they reintroduce these tendencies with liberalism to replace what people lost when they turned away from the church, which I believe is part of the goal there. So let's continue. Find exactly where I was here. Jung interpreted the discoveries of the Uruk school in the following manner. Within each native European, there was a living pre-Christian layer of unconscious psyche that produced religious images from the Hellenic pagan mystery cults or even archaic nature religions of the ancient Aryans. The phylogenetic unconsciousness does not produce purely Christian symbols, but instead offers pagan images such as that of the Son as God. If the sediment of 2,000 years of Judeo-Christian culture could be disturbed, as in psychotic mental diseases with a physiological component such as dementia praecox, then this Semitic mask might be removed, and the biologically true images of the God within could be revealed. A natural god, perhaps a god of the sun or stars like Mithras, or matriarchal goddess of the moon or blood, or Phallic or Chthonic gods from within Mother Earth. It was precisely these images that dominated the ancient Hellenistic mysteries that most fascinated Jung. The mysteries of Mithras, the Eleusinian mysteries, the mysteries of Dionysus, the Great Mother, Isis and Osiris. Many of these images also overlap with the alleged mysteries of the ancient Teutons, or perhaps the Aryan Ur-religion. To Jung, the mystery cults of antiquity kept alive the ancient natural religion of human prehistory and were a corrective antidote to the poison of religions like Judaism and Christianity that have been forged by civilization. Jung regarded Christianity as a Jewish religion that was cruelly imposed on the pagan peoples of Europe. Since Judaism was the product of an older and higher level of civilization than the European pagans, it had separated people from nature. The Aryans of Europe, especially the German peoples, had been civilized only 1,000 years ago, and therefore closer to the ancestors and their Ur-religion of the sun and sky and sacred groves of trees. Semitic cultures cut off from the primordial source of life did not have mysteries in which a direct experience of the god could be sustained through initiation rituals. They were, therefore, cut off from the renewal and rebirth that such mysteries offered the Aryans. In his book on the Mithraic liturgy, Albrecht Dietrich compares the central image of the rebirth in ancient India and the mysteries of Isis and other cultural contexts, but notes that the Jews do not have this image. Only Aryans could receive the sacrament of redemption. Jung often referred to the ancient mysteries as secret or hidden or underground religions and their social organizations as the secret hidden churches that kept alive the divine spark from the dawn of creation. This leads us to an obvious conclusion. When Jung became one with the Aeon in his visionary initiation experience, in his imagination, he was not only becoming a full participant in the mysteries of Mithras, he was experiencing a direct initiation into the most ancient of mysteries of his Aryan ancestors. His new science of psychoanalysis became the 20th century vehicle of these mysteries. Most importantly, as his initiation experience also entailed assuming the stance of the crucified Jesus as he metamorphized into Aeon, Jung thereby became the figure that fueled the fantasies of the Volkish Germans and the European and American anti-Semites at the turn of the century, the Aryan Christ. Now, I will go on to say, while some may say it seems foolhardy for us to look to these ancient religions for guidance in our modern-day lives, but we see that the Jungian psychoanalysis method, which are actually the working ones, come from these workings, as well as scholars into the Vedics include Tesla, Ford. Heisenberg. And many, many others. In fact, many of the early Renaissance era philosophers and inventors were highly influenced by these sort of Hermes Trismegistus was a big one in the Thoth mysteries. And while it seems abstract, I think why this works is because it is our natural religion, the religion of our blood, and not an inverted Jewish form. And while sort of like Moore's Law in a computer sort of will always double its computing power in a set number of years, so, like the human mind works, but it was sort of operating without a couple critical pieces of hardware and wasn't able to operate correctively. But this sort of intellectual capacity increased. So, when we look back and form connections with these ancient mysteries, our subconscious all along. And so when we look back to these methods and different ways of looking at the universe, we are able to reconnect all of that hardware that was disconnected and see things that might have occurred and inventions that might have occurred along the timeline if Christianity were never to have existed. Now, it would probably be a lot more advanced if we hadn't done so. But I think it's a necessary way for us to fight, because not only It would give us methods of invention, but also methods of combat and methods of fighting back against the sort of power structure and the inspiration and zeitgeist that we need to actually defeat this sort of foe. They're using all their knowledge, but they're not connected to the source, they're not connected to the earth. So their ability to come up with structures and cages to sort of limit us and getting back to our roots, I think this would be very important. And this, I'm going to get into this next week. We're going to talk about the Christian right and so forth. I think I'll just finish off this chapter here. And now, this is expanding on the Arian Christ. At first glance, it seems to be a paradox, an Arian Christ. Isn't that a contradiction in terms? But for personal and cultural reasons, and affirming resonance of the inner with the outer, this symbol of paradoxical divinity made Sun Tzu Jung in ways that are difficult to understand today. A magician, a healer, and most important, as a redeemer, the God-man Christ fascinated and repulsed Jung since childhood. But nonetheless, when Jung began to have fantasies of leading a movement to revitalize human spirituality, first through psychoanalysts and then through his own movement, the living presence of Christ in his ancestral soul proved to be an irresistible model. This was true even though Jung had fully accepted his new pagan self-identity by December 1913. In an age dominated by a widely accepted Volkish worldview, it is perfectly understandable that Jung's self-deification would take this form. For many decades before Jung became conscious that he was the Arian Christ for a new age, there had been a wide-ranging debate in German culture, not only about the historical reality of Jesus of Nazareth, but whether he was 100% Jewish. Fables of all sorts about non-Semitic tribes of Aryans being the original occupants of the Holy Land, who may have transmitted their blood to Jesus or through true biological father of Jesus being a Roman centurion, circulated within Volkish circles. Houston Stuart Chamberlain, a member of the inner circle at Bayreuth after Richard Wagner's death, was an internationally recognized proponent of these views at the turn of the century. His best-known work, the two-volume Die Grundlagen des Neuen Jahrhunderts, something like that, The Foundations of the was read and discussed. And Chamberlain argued that there are too many Indo-European, Indo-Aryan, or Aryan elements in the tenets of Christianity and in the personality of Jesus to believe that Christ or his ideas were in any way Jewish. Using philological and historical evidence, Chamberlain claimed that it is a mistake to believe that only the Semitic races in Galilee in the years before the birth of Jesus. He placed the Hellenes in that area at that time and argued that the population could not possibly have been entirely Semitic, and he argued, given the Aryan characteristics of Jesus and his ideas, given that the race is perhaps the most important determinant of personality, the modern view of Jesus should be revised. The biology of race should replace language and cultural history as the determinants of ethnicity, especially that of Christ. In a characteristic passage, Chamberlain said, "Yet it will not do simply to put race aside as a negligible quantity. Still less will it do to proclaim anything directly false about race and to let such a historical lie crystallize in an indisputable dogma. Whoever makes the assertion that Christ is a Jew is either ignorant or insincere. Ignorant when he confuses religion and race, insincere when he knows the history of Galilee and partially conceals, partially distorts, and the very entangled facts in favor of the religious prejudices it may be to hold curie favor with the Jews. The possibility that Christ was no Jew and he had not a drop of genuinely Jewish blood in his veins is so great that it's almost equivalent to a certainty. To which race did he belong? That is a question that cannot be answered by all. Now, I don't particularly agree with this prospect. Now, it seems to be either a conscious or unconscious transposition, which one that is quite old. And because the speak of these characters are Aryan is foolhardy. They speak of all are the same under God. They speak that you have to sort of give up your free will, which was the true argument, true reason of the argument of Christ and the Pharisees. But it seems that the Aryan man sort of wants a redeemer or redeeming figure. An interesting quality, but I'll continue to read here. But statements such as Christ became the Christ of the young, vigorous Indo-Europeans little leave doubt that Chamberlain believed him to be a superior product of the Aryan race. To be sure, many theologians objected to this revisionism, but such racialist philosophy was quite popular and considered to be based on good science. Even Jung quotes from the work in a footnote in Walk in London and Symbole der Libido. Given Chamberlain's fame as a leading racialist thinker and anti-Semite, this citation must have left off the page at Freud and his Jewish colleagues. Indeed, most of Freud's statements that Jung was anti-Semitic there in 1912, the year the second part of Wandlungen appeared. Richard Wagner intended to believe that such stories of the Aryan racial elements of Jesus, and these are mostly, like, I believe, to be sort of transpositions, personifications that people want to push on this idea of a character, not to admit their own sort of falsehoods, the same sort of cowardice that people exhibit when they feel they need to be under the wing of a sort of vengeful God, and the cushy prospect of an afterlife, you know. It's ultimately weakness. Now, Wagner in his opera Parzival is laden with images of a young knight. Parzival is a pagan Christ figure and redeemer. Jung experienced the Wagnerian mysteries of Parzival as a young man and moved him deeply. The focus of the story is a holy order of knights whose duty is it to guard the Holy Grail. The chalice filled with the blood of Christ as a potent votive symbol as the sacred container of pure Aryan blood. Spiritual redemption and renewal sprang from this mystical tower of blood, which must be protected at all costs. When Parzival arrives on the scene, all is not well within the community of Grail Knights. The Holy Spear that lands the body of Christ and therefore has tremendous healing properties has been stolen by the evil magician Klingzor with the help of the seductress Kundry, who, by her own account, is Jewish. And Forta, sovereign of the Grail Kingdom, lies in perpetual agony from a wound that never heals, inflicted by Klingzor with a magical spear. The Grail is therefore unguarded and vulnerable to Klingzor. Percival, a stranger to the night, stumbles upon his role as a hero, retrieves the spear, heals Amfortas with a touch of his own tip, redeems the fallen Kundry through an act of love, and restores order to the kingdom. In the final act, accompanied by Wagner's transformation music, Parzival waves the Holy Grail over a congregation of Teutonic Grail Knights as everyone sings out the final mystical words of the drama. Highest healings wonder, redemption to the Redeemer. Based on Cosimo Wagner's diaries, many commentators had argued that this last line meant that Jesus, the Christian Savior God himself, need to be redeemed from his Jewish origins. Others dispute this, but undoubtedly, Parzival is a Volkish epiphany and the highest dramatic expression of the longing for an Aryan Christ. And Bayreuth itself is the only place where one could see the performance of Parzival before 1913, was hailed by Volkish enthusiasts as the new mystery cult site where the great Aryan mysteries could reach their full expression. Beliefs such as these were held by a great number of educated persons, not only in German culture, but in the entire Judeo-Christian world at the turn of the century. Yet, even for persons who lapsed occasionally into the anti-Semitism like Jung and many German scholars and theologians, it is difficult to simply erase every trace of Christianity because of its Semitic origins. Instead, the myth of an Aryan Christ comforted those bourgeoisie members of the Volk who could not turn to the worship of the sun or retreat to the Teutoburg forest to make animal sacrifices to Wotan or Thor. Now, this is a bit... This author is a bit biased. I'll continue. As the historian George Molsing notes in his magistral analysis of the Volkish movement, another tendency of Volkish thought was to substantiate the image of the Volk for the person and function of the Christ. Transpositions and substitutions that stretch the bounds of logic were presented as solutions for racially cleansing the body of Christ. Teach me the secret ruins. Some Volkish scholars and their readers found their inspiration as a remarkable manuscript that had been written in Old Saxon in 1830 CE, but published in modern German in 1830. This untitled manuscript, from which its publisher titled The Highland or Savior, is the first rendering of the New Testament Gospel into the language of the ancient Germans. In this Gospel, Jesus is Germanized as the role of a chieftain of a group of warrior companions or apostles. Since the author of this 9th century text was attempting to speak directly to the hearts and mind of his northern European contemporaries who were still largely pagan, Jesus here takes on the familiar tributes of Wotan. Christ the chieftain is a magician like Wotan and knows the secret of the ruins. Also like Wotan, who had the ravens Ninon and Hugin, memory and mind, perched on his shoulders, Christ the chieftain often has a dove, a symbol of the Holy Spirit, on his. Jung cultivated a special relationship to Wotan and believed him to be a true god of the Germanic peoples of Europe. Wotan came to him in a dream in the form of a wild huntsman as a sign. He was taking the soul of Jung's mother with him to the land of the dead. Wotan appeared in other guises as well throughout Jung's life, like Eugen Böhler, who was on very intimate terms with Jung in 1955 onward. Recall that Jung had several intuitions about death and the death of his mother before the First World War and the death of his wife. On both occasions, there was Wotan, the German god who is said to dominate Northern Europe. He had a dream of Wotan riding in the sky. Excuse me, I had to cough there. Wotan is also a psychopampos, one who leads the souls of the dead like Hermes. Böhler added, Jung had several dreams with Wotan flying, so to speak, Beside him by the lake was at Bolligen. Perhaps Jung was right that Wotan was the living god of the German people. In Jung's own Switzerland, even to this day, double beam, tourist rites, or Wotan crosses still watch over the landscape in the hinterlands of the Canton of Luisen, awaiting the return of Wotan's wild hunt for souls. The 19th song of the Heiland, the mighty chieftain leader of self, the rescuer, the son of ruler, the guardian of the land, the chieftain of mankind, was surrounded by his warrior companions on a mountain. They eagerly awaited his instructions. He spoke to the 12 heroes, telling them many wondrous things, but they wished to know more than words. Gyrti us dat Grunai, one of the more intelligent men cried out, teach us of the secret of the ruins. The powerful one said, when you want to speak to the ruling god to address the most powerful of all kings, then say what I now teach you. The magic spell he taught them, as we know, is in different form as the Lord's Prayer. Now, this is somewhat important. I'll take different interpretations than the author in this respect. Message here. Now, in this transposition, especially with Parzival, and we see Parzival already in the image of in regalia of Christ with Christic symbolism, and the Grail representing Aryan blood, and it speaks of Parzival as the Redeemer to the Redeemer. And Parzival's story is not quite the same as Christ's at all. Parzival was raised in the wilderness. He was born of nature, a pagan. And through, and he strikes down his enemy as opposed to being a victim of one. And, sort of a conquering hero and a redeemer for the Aryans. Now, we know if we look into the Jewish religion of the Essenes at the Dead Sea Scrolls, these texts do speak of a redeemer, not a redeemer to the Jews. Now, many say that the Jews are directly hostile towards Christ, but this really can be argued. I mean, if they really wanted to attack Christianity, maybe they could take a note from the last couple shows that we've been doing on this network. Most of it aligns to the fact that the Jews focus on making the right in America a bunch of religious zealots. And that when the left, and they sort of just playing ping pong back and forth and softballing topics back against, back towards each other in minor issues that no one should really care too much about, more so than the larger issues. And they agree on mostly everything else, but they'll be like, oh yeah, well, Jesus is silly, or something of that nature. And it's not truly attacking them. And they do keep to sort of press up this system and what Mike Slide sort of calls the synthesis of what they're trying to do now. This sort of synthesis of this communism and Christianity, because they're both the same thing, and neither are strong enough to truly hold down the Aryan populace any longer. But Parzival's story is one that rescues the Grail or the Aryan blood away from religion itself and from Christ. So this is, and this was the seat of the mysteries, a sort of secret of the mysteries, and also what is spoken of the Aryan Redeemer, the Aryan sort of messianic figure, you will see in the Vedic avatar system. Now, what's important about this and Wotanism and Weimar Germany in this era and this sort of consciousness and this strive for redemption was able to, in a Semitic form, take the Jews who are once seen as the dregs of society, the Aryan laws of Manu, the caste laws, saw them as the fourth level or the Shandala people. And through this sort of a mystical working, they were able to transpose themselves from the bottom caste of society to the top. And it's an empowering method and a method of the Kali Yuga. But through striving, through this method, which may be an Aryan method to begin with, and through these sort of mythological ideas, and no one all has to do it either. Probably the best method for the entirety of the sort of truth movement would be the sort of boots on the ground, would be not to get too busy talking about religion at all, especially in one as empty and useless as Christianity. But there is value in some of us, and bashing Christianity is part of that, in forming this sort of what became the dual society and these mystic energy gatherers, right? And like even through things like and connecting oneself with nature, so one can learn to divert the generative powers of it, much like the Thule society did, and much like the Neo-Volkists and those who saw and dreamed of Parzival in Germany, and those who dreamed of a better world through distinctly Aryan means. And like when we do these shows here on Renegade, we're not appealing to anybody, everybody. I mean, we always movement. And so when you get these fucking people who are running around like, oh, why you guys bash the Jews? We're not fucking talking to you if you're too stupid to understand it, all right? So you should probably go fuck yourself. Maybe go listen to some Tex Mars or some 101 bullshit and stop bothering us, all right? And not to be too hard, maybe, you know, there's a little bit of it in it for everybody, but we're here trying to be the Thule society, not the sort of Jewspiracy 101 types here, all right? So with that, I will play myself out and continue on maybe with some similar stuff next week, or I'll put some more time into setting that up. But I'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.